Welcome to the A-Level Politics Show. If this is your first ever A-Level Politics Show listen, then hello, hello, hello. I hope you enjoy it. And if you do, why not think about subscribing to Plus Plus Plus, where you get two bonus pods each month in addition to this one, as well as our EG for Me service that helps you apply recent news stories to exam questions, and even better, access to all A-Level Politics Show podcasts that have ever been made. It's just £1.99 a month and can be cancelled at any time. Deets are in the show notes. So what will we be discussing today? Given the scale of industrial unrest in the public sector and the number of protests, both illegal and otherwise, I thought it time to return to this issue of participation in the UK. Is there a participation crisis? The last time we looked at this was back in episode 71, so about 2 years ago. I think it's time for a refresh. So here it is. How rude of me. I haven't even defined what a participation crisis is. For me, a participation crisis is the refusal of a significant number of citizens to engage in political activity, either through traditional or non-traditional forms of participation. So what are traditional forms of participation? They are methods like voting, joining a political party, taking industrial action, striking, essentially, belonging to a trade union. Now, the conventional wisdom is that these traditional methods are in decline, yet that is not necessarily correct. And I'll come on to argue that we don't have a participation crisis in either traditional or non-traditional forms of participation. So what are non-traditional methods of participation? Well, I regard non-traditional methods as recent methods, so social media activity, online activity, and also I would regard e-petitions as a very recent form of political participation. And I'm going to add to that joining a pressure group and taking part in pressure group activities through direct action. Although direct action has existed for a very long time, I think we can say that there are newer methods of direct action, or perhaps more radical methods of direct action. So we have to look at whether people are participating in those or whether actually actions of groups like Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil are putting people off. But my overall view is that there is not a participation crisis in this country. And it's very important at the start of your essays, whether you're in the lower sixth starting out your A-level career in politics or in the upper sixth and you know all this, very important to say what you think at the start of your essay. So what do I think? I think there isn't a participation crisis. So I'm going to structure my essay in that way. I'm going to build up the arguments to suggest there is a participation crisis in all of these forms of participation. And then I'm going to make the case that in nearly all forms of participation, we can either explain away the lowering activity. So, for example, people aren't joining parties, but that doesn't necessarily show that there is a participation crisis. It may be that people just don't like the political parties and what they've got to say. And I'm going to then really argue the case that people are agitating, people are campaigning, and people are voting. And that perhaps beneath it all, maybe due to the social and economic conditions of the times we live in, that there is a yearning to change the political system, or at least register our say in how the country is governed. You just have to look a little bit more closely at the data and also look at what people are doing. Anyway, that's enough from me. It's going to be me after the break as well. Let's start with voting. When it comes to voting, we measure participation by turnout, which is defined as the percentage of people who are eligible to vote and who actually then decide to do so. There is evidence to suggest that there is a crisis. In 2019, the turnout for the general election was 67.3%. That's down 1.5% from the election in 2017. It is also well below the high levels of the 1970s, where it reached 78.8% in 1974. Between 1964 to 1997, average turnout was around 75%. Yet average turnout between 2005 to 2019 was around 66%. That's 9% lower. Turnout also varies according to wealth and occupation. In 2019, 68% of high-income AB voters, we call them, cast a ballot, compared to only 53% of low-income voters, DE voters, we call them. These statistics suggest that those who are at the sharp end of society have the least faith that there are political solutions to their plight, and they express that through non-voting. Many people feel that their vote doesn't count due to the first-past-the-post electoral system. People who live in safe seats cast wasted votes. They know that and therefore don't bother to go to the ballot box. As a representative democracy, it is vital that turnout is high so that the resulting government can claim to have a legitimate mandate to enact the policies in their manifesto. Perhaps the multiple scandals involving politicians, though, has reduced that legitimacy and has had a knock-on effect on dampening election turnout, especially for a by-election. In June 2023, when a by-election was called after the resignation of David Warburton MP due to allegations of sexual misconduct, a voter in his Somerton and Frome constituency said, "Oh, pants," when speaking to a Guardian reporter. "I'm fed up with all these by-elections. They're a waste of time. Politicians need to get on and run the country, not keep banging on our doors, bothering us." Even in the USA, a country with historically low turnout, we have seen a catch-up with the UK turnout figures, with 67% of Americans voting in the 2020 presidential election. That's about the same as the 2019 general election over here. Meanwhile, both the UK and USA lag behind several other countries. For example, the 2021 federal German elections saw 77% turnout. So perhaps there is a culture of voting that is more ingrained in other democracies than in the UK. Perhaps there is a greater sense that voting is a civic duty. Turnout tends to be even lower at other elections in the UK, aside from general elections. Even in the new devolved institutions, which have different voting systems, turnout remains low. So you can't blame first past the post for no one or few people voting in the Scottish parliamentary elections or the Welsh Senate elections. In fact, the Welsh Senate elections in 2021 saw only 47% turnout. London mayoral election turnout in 2021 saw just 41% of eligible voters casting a ballot. That was down 4% from 2016. Perhaps these turnout stats, though, show that voters do not feel these bodies make a huge difference to their lives, and that the real action lies in Westminster. Notice that I'm not just giving you statistics, by the way. I'm also giving you reasons, because when you are writing about the participation crisis, you get AO1 for knowledge, examples, stuff you know, but you also get AO2, which is analysis, explaining the reasons behind these statistics. But I'm arguing, of course, that there is not a crisis. So I'm going to challenge some of these statistics, some of these arguments that I've given. From 2001 to 2017, general election turnout did steadily increase. It only fell in 2019, owing to the time of year, December, that the election was held. Low turnout does not necessarily result from a lack of political engagement. Many others might argue that the real crisis is to do with our electoral system and not an unwillingness to participate. It's just a logical conclusion that voters arrive at when they say their vote doesn't count because the electoral system is so unfair. Maybe that is true. If it was fairer, maybe they would vote in greater numbers. For politically active people living in safe seats, it could arguably make more sense to abstain and participate in other ways. Maybe abstention is a form of political participation because it's registering people's dissatisfaction with politics. Importantly, non-voters still generally recognise the government's legitimacy, even if they believe the election and the main political parties to be deeply flawed. They recognise that the government won a free and fair election, even if they consider the rules to be imperfect. Thus, lower turnout doesn't constitute a crisis as such in participation specifically. Referendums provide increased turnout as well. So people do vote when they feel their vote counts. The Scottish independence referendum in 2014 saw an 85% turnout in that country. 2021 Scottish parliamentary elections saw turnout rose by 7.6% on the previous parliamentary election in Scotland. And the EU referendum in 2016 saw a 72% turnout across the UK. So I think people engage when the stakes appear high, and the Scottish independence referendum was a high stakes referendum, along with the EU referendum. When the result is close, and so I think we've seen a fair few close general elections recently, 2015, 2017, and so people turn out in higher numbers. And if there is an underlining sense of grievance with a party in power or system, along with an alternative that appears to be radically different. Indeed, turnout to the Scottish parliamentary elections in 2021 rose to 63%, perhaps owing to a sense that a second independence referendum might be affected by the outcome. Turnout to the other devolved body elections is perhaps only low because these elections are not as important to people as general elections. That doesn't mean there is a crisis. It means that these bodies aren't powerful enough to make people feel bothered to vote. Perhaps giving these bodies more power is the answer. And let's also think about youth turnout in the 2017 general election. I said that people turn out when they feel that there is an alternative. And certainly youth turnout in 2017 rose in part because of a clear alternative between the Labour government, Labour Party and the Conservative government, because Labour offered free tuition. And that may have led to what we call the youth quake, people voting, people who are younger, who tend not to vote in greater numbers, did actually turn out in that election. Now let's come to political parties and joining political parties. There is strong evidence to suggest that there is a crisis here. Only around 1% of the population are members of a political party. There has been considerable partisan de-alignment in recent decades, with far fewer voters strongly identifying with a particular party, loyally supporting them from one election to election. Labour Party membership stood at 430,000 in 2021, in stark contrast to the 1 million members it had in 1953. The Conservative Party had only 200,000 members in 2021 compared to 2.8 million in 1953. And what of the quality of participation when you join a political party? A lot of members simply don't attend the local meetings held by their constituency branches. The Labour Party CLPs are often highly divisive, where there has been lots of arguments between the left wing of the party and the centrists in the party, and that's put people off attending those meetings, even at a local level. However, I think there's plenty of evidence or plenty of arguments to suggest that there is not a crisis. Corbyn's elevation to leader of the Labour Party swelled that party's membership to around 500,000, albeit temporarily. Other parties have also seen rises in their membership, such as the SNP. The membership declines of the major parties also reflect class and partisan de-alignment. Voters are less loyal to one political party. That doesn't mean that they are apathetic. It just means they don't like what the two main parties have to offer. So I'm going to move on to the third and final form of traditional participation: joining trade unions and taking industrial action. Trade unions are organisations who defend the rights, pay, terms and conditions of their members and usually represent employees in a specific occupation. They attempt to persuade employers and the government, if they're in the public sector, to further the interests of their members and sometimes call on members to strike, that is, to refuse to work, to withdraw their labour in order to pressurise employers and the government to back down and give them better terms and conditions and pay. We often gauge participation by trade union members by the levels of industrial unrest, by the numbers of strikes. There is evidence to suggest that there is a crisis. The number of employees in the UK who were trade union members fell to 6.25 million in 2022, well down on the 1979 peak of 13.2 million. The reasons for this: trade union legislation, perhaps, that was quite restrictive in the 1980s after that too, but also the working from home culture more recently and the changing nature of work means that people don't necessarily rub shoulders with people who have similar experiences and join the same groups, people perhaps are more likely to work for themselves or work in isolation from others. We also had divisions within unions. In 2016, junior doctors rejected the new contract that their own leaders, their own union leaders, had negotiated with the government. So if you've got divisions within unions, you perhaps get greater despondency and frustration with union membership, and people then stop being members of that union. Some question the impact of unions and their ability to deliver for their members. Wave after wave of public sector strikes in the 2022 to 2023 era have not produced the above inflation pay rises that unions have been demanding. The Sunak government, as of July 2023 at the time of recording, has yet to give in to the pay demands of public sector unions representing teachers, train drivers and civil servants. Strikes also cost individuals money, and so many people don't then go on strike. You don't get paid most of the time for withdrawing your labour. The Trade Union Act 2016 makes striking difficult, which limits the impact that unions have and consequently the perception that joining a union is beneficial. The Conservatives are, as of July 2023, pushing ahead with further plans to restrict striking by requiring minimum service levels in key sectors of the economy during strikes, which may mean that even if you want to go and strike to show support for your union and to put pressure on the government, you may not be allowed to. However, I think there is a lot of evidence and a lot of arguments to suggest that there is not a crisis when it comes to trade union membership and action taken by members of trade unions. The decline in trade union membership primarily occurred in the private sector. Since 1995, membership amongst public sector employees has stayed relatively steady. Around 50% of the public sector belong to a trade union. Specific unions have very active members. Sixth form teachers belonging to the NEU went on strike on three separate occasions in the autumn of 2019 to 2020 term and participated in multiple days of industrial action in the 2022 to 2023 academic year. Nearly every junior doctor who participated in the ballot on industrial action voted to strike in 2023 with a turnout of around 77%. So even if you're not going on strike, you are still voting on whether there should be industrial action. The increasing ease with which to join a march or demonstration due to social media through your trade union or through other groups has perhaps replaced the strike as the main form of direct action. So even if your union or even if a pressure group you belong to is not on strike, it still may well be that you can participate in other forms of activity. The wave of public sector strikes demonstrates that employees will stand up for their rights, for their pay, for their terms and conditions when they feel that these things are under threat from the government. The cost of living crisis and over a decade of pay restraint in the public sector has meant that employees are more willing to withdraw their labour and agitate for political change. Now, let's turn to non-traditional methods of participation. Now, if the essay is just, is there a participation crisis? I think you need a mix of traditional and non-traditional forms of participation. It might well be that the examiner asks you to compare levels of participation when it comes to traditional forms of participation and non-traditional forms of participation. So it's important to be aware of these. I'm going to focus on three non-traditional methods of participation: use of social media, e-petitions and pressure group activity. So let's focus first on social media activity. Arguably, social media simply allows people to engage with others who share similar views to them. Twitter is merely an echo chamber. Is that really meaningful political participation simply by retweeting something from someone who you agree with? The kinds of participation on social media sites can potentially result in harmful forms of participation, hate speech, for example, and may well put people off from engaging in political discussion and debate. According to one forecast in 2022, more than 30 million people will leave Twitter within the next 2 years owing to Elon Musk's takeover and his removal of safeguards that have seen the proliferation of hate speech and harmful content on that social media site. However, social media has enabled a far greater volume of political activity at minimal cost. It allows constituents to communicate directly and quickly with politicians. I remember when I lived in a flat in Streatham, two bedroom flat. We had a very young baby, just a few months old, and there was a massive party beneath us. It was an illegal party because the person living there was subletting, and it was a bit of a DOS house, quite frankly. And the music went on all through the night. It was an absolute nightmare. And in my frustration, I tweeted my then MP, Chuck Ramuna. It must have been about 1 a.m. And he actually tweeted back and he asked where I lived and he suggested who I should get in touch with. So that was a kind of instant back and forth between myself and my representative in Parliament. I mean, he didn't actually then go and do anything and the party then ended and we all slept during the day on Saturday. But I think it demonstrates that instantaneous ability to connect with decision makers has meant that social media has become a useful way for people to participate quickly and effectively in politics. The BBC breaking news account on Twitter has 10 million followers, or had 10 million followers in 2021, and the UK Prime Minister had 5.8 million followers in 2022. Social media has become an important source of political information and has resulted in greater transparency when it comes to government decisions. Things are often leaked online first. And then we have e-petitions. Now, e-petitions were introduced in 2015 and allow the public to raise issues that may have been overlooked by Parliament. If a petition is signed by more than 100,000 people, Parliament must consider the issue for debate. Now, is there a crisis when it comes to e-petitions? Many e-petitions aren't debated in Parliament at all, which could put people off from signing them if they don't feel that it's going to lead to anywhere or anything or any debate. Of the 8,154 e-petitions launched on the Parliament's petition website between 2017 and 2019, only 456 received a government response. If people feel that an action they take won't amount to much, maybe they won't necessarily continue to take a similar action in the future. There is also the question of how engaged people are after signing the petition. I must admit that I've got a friend who constantly sends me e-petitions. And at first I was signing them because I agree with what they say. And now it just feels like this explosion in e-petitions has meant that I sometimes ignore calls to sign e-petitions. So maybe the inflation of e-petition use has devalued its currency. But I'm going to push back against that. People continue to sign e-petitions as a means of putting pressure on the government. It is a means to an end. Between 2015 to 2020, the House of Commons Library reported that 23 million people signed e-petitions on its website. Many more signed e-petitions on other websites, including 38 Degrees. These actions can be the first step in a process to change the law. The End Period Poverty campaign began with an e-petition to scrap the tampon tax and resulted in the scrapping of VAT on sanitary products. This resulting momentum has led to calls for going further and ending VAT on period knickers. So you can see that perhaps e-petitions don't get instant change, but they can build a movement very easily and very simply and allow that movement to push for more things down the line. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you an important message. Matthew Phillips is in the house. How are you, Matthew?
I'm very well. How are you, Nick?
I'm really good. Tell us your news.
The news is there is a podcast for A-level students and teachers alike, and it is very much like the beloved A-level politics show.
What, a rival podcast?
Like the A-level politics show. It's meant to, I don't know, have a great relationship with.
Okay, tell us more.
So as I say, it's for students who study A-level history, but it's also for teachers as well. If you've loved the A-level politics show, you might like the A-level history podcast. And every week we dig deep into what you need to know about A-level history. We're currently looking at the Cold War. We also cover essay questions, primary source questions, and interpretations questions as well. In past episodes, we have explored the differences between the Soviet Union and Western liberal democracy. We've also looked at the relationship between Clement Attlee, Harry Truman, and Joseph Stalin in the most recent episode. But I know what you love most about the A-Level Politics show is how it breaks down key concepts and helps you answer difficult essay questions. So in future episodes, in fact, the next episode, we're going to be looking at how to answer essay questions in A-Level History. All your fantastic sentence starters will be there, examples, and also thinking about how you can structure your answer as well. So yeah, if you've loved the A-Level Politics show, you might like the A-Level History podcast.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm certainly going to listen to it. Thanks, Matthew, and on with the show. Now, I'm going to come on to the most traditional form of non-traditional forms of participation, and that is joining a pressure group. Many pressure groups use the two forms of campaigning that I just mentioned, social media, e-petitions, to further their causes, but they also utilise direct action in the form of public protest to advance a cause. So let's look at the evidence, the arguments to suggest there is a crisis. How involved are people when they join a pressure group? Many members are just simply checkbook members, to use the old currency, if you like. People don't really use checkbooks anymore, but I think you get what I mean. They pay their membership fees to a pressure group and do little else, primarily joining pressure groups for the benefits that that membership offers. Maybe they join the National Trust so they can get the free car parking, for example. Even if people did wish to become actively involved in the groups that they join, the power in many pressure groups is often top-down, controlled by unelected leaders rather than their members. People are put off by protests that cause a mass public disturbance by some pressure groups. Just Stop Oil have interrupted high-profile snooker games, glued themselves to goalposts at Premier League football matches, and Extinction Rebellion prevented tube trains from leaving the station, causing misery for hundreds of commuters. These activities have maybe deterred people from supporting such groups since they are associated with extremist actions that are potentially self-defeating. I think stopping a tube train leaving a station in the name of reducing carbon emissions perhaps was the most obvious example of a self-defeating action by an environmental group. The government has also made it harder to protest with its Policing Act 2022 that bans noisy protests and the Public Order Act 2023 that gives the police sweeping powers to prevent people from attending demonstrations. Peaceful campaigners from the anti-monarchy group Republic were arrested at the King's coronation in May 2023, despite no evidence of the group wanting to cause a mass disturbance. This legislation and the misuse or overuse of it by police is likely to deter ordinary members of the public from participating in the demonstrations. I remember hearing from one protester in the group Republic who said that they were wary of attending a demonstration because they locked their bike up at Victoria Station, and then they carried their bike lock with them in their bag, as so many people do when they lock their bikes up. But then they realised that the police could say that would be used, the bike lock, to lock onto public buildings and so on, which would constitute a mass disturbance, and that could lead to their arrest just for having that bike lock under the Public Order Act. And so they were wary of actually attending these demonstrations. So I think that these laws it's very hard to know in numbers just how many people will not attend demonstrations, because the public perception might be that it could lead to their arrest. But I'm going to push back against that as well. The fact that so much direct action has been carried out in the last 2 years is testament to the fact that people are participating. Extinction Rebellion has indicated that it will shift its tactics and that its campaigns will seek to be more inclusive. That suggests that Extinction Rebellion acknowledge themselves that some of their actions are self-defeating, and then will try and change those to allow people like myself who I quite like going on demonstrations, quite frankly. I've taken my kids on demonstrations to do with public sector cuts. I've taken my kids on the anti-Brexit marches and so on. And so I think that Extinction Rebellion might well be trying to appeal to people who are ordinary, if you like, rather than people who do want to chain themselves to railings, which I certainly don't want to do. It is taking a bet, that group, that people do want to participate so long as the demonstrations are open and safe to all. The anti-Brexit demonstrations were attended by at least 1 million people, and it was a family affair. People are also far more likely to engage in less abstract and more specific causes, specifically ones that affect them individually where they live. Fair funding for schools was enormously effective at engaging teachers, head teachers and parents in campaigning against education cuts by pointing out the specific cuts that individual schools might face and the numbers of specific teachers who might lose their jobs. In 2022, renters' rights group Acorn organised a demonstration at Bristol City Hall to protest against high rents. Similar protests by tenants have put pressure on the government to ban no-fault evictions in its latest housing bill. Again, it seems that people protest and engage in politics when the cause is relevant to them, in this case, high rental costs, and when they feel that their actions are having some kind of effect. In this instance, getting the government to write into law that people can't be evicted simply for existing. So here comes my conclusion. Trust in politics after the expenses scandal has clearly declined. Does that make people apathetic, or does it make them angry enough to participate? I think it makes people angry enough to participate. It is too simplistic to look at voting. The social media explosion represents participation, even if the quality of that participation is questionable. Referendums appear to have ignited interest in politics, even though the Hansard Society findings suggest that this level of interest is not guaranteed to be permanent. The political crisis over Brexit exhausted people and activated people in equal measure. There is a crisis in some forms of participation, maybe, say, joining political parties, but not in others. The extent to which there is a crisis perhaps depends on the value attached to different forms of participation. If we think that sending a tweet is participation and meaningful, then there isn't a crisis. If we think that it is just clicktivism, as some people call it, then there is a crisis. Yet taking together all of these actions in all the different methods that I've outlined, perhaps we can make the argument that the participation crisis thesis is overblown. People will participate when they feel that there is an outcome that will benefit them. They will participate if participation is easy. They will participate if they are not happy with their situation specifically. The cost of living crisis has arguably ushered in, alongside a pretty unpopular government, a form of protest and industrial action not seen since the 1970s. At the time of recording, it remained to be seen whether the traditional forms of participation will also reflect this frustration in equal measure to these non-traditional forms of participation when it comes to, say, voting turnout at the next general election. I think then we will have a better idea, we can gauge more effectively the extent to which there is or isn't a participation crisis. I hope you found this podcast useful. Thank you so much for listening. Do subscribe to Plus if you're really enjoying it, to get all the goodies, all the benefits that I outlined at the beginning of the show. Until the next time, though, take care, folks. Enjoy the sunshine if that's when you're listening in the summer. If not, wrap up warm. Take care. Bye.